9. To Clint, the warden's office had an archaeological appearance, as if it had been abandoned for years instead of less than a week. Janice Coates lay on the couch, wrapped in her cerements of white. Michaela went to her and knelt down. She stroked the cocoon with one hand. It gave off crackling sounds. Garth started to approach her, but Clint took his arm. Give her a minute, Dr. Flickinger. It was actually more like 3 before Michaela got to her feet. What can we do? She asked. Can you be persistent and persuasive? Clint asked. She fixed him with eyes that were no longer bloodshot. I came to News America as an unpaid intern at 23. By 26, I was a full-time correspondent, and they were talking about giving me my own evening show. She saw Billy giving a look to Tig and Rand and smiled at them. You know what they say around here, don't you? It ain't bragging if it's the truth. She returned her attention to Clint. Those are my references. Are they good enough?
I hope so, Clint said.
Listen. He talked for the next 5 minutes. There were questions, but not many. They were in a bad corner, and all of them knew it. Chapter 6 1 Alexander Peter Bear, the first baby to be born on the other side of the tree, son of a former dueling inmate named Linda Bear, breathed air for the first time a week after Lila and Tiffany returned from the wreck below Lionhead. It was another few days before Lila made his acquaintance at a small gathering in Elaine Nutting Geary's repaired home. He was not a traditionally attractive infant. The stacking of his many jowls produced an association not with the Gerber baby, but with a bookie that Lila had once arrested who had been known as Larry Large. However, baby Alexander had an irresistibly comic way of rolling his eyes around, as if he were anxiously attempting to gain his bearings amid the flowering of female faces that loomed above him. A plate of slightly crispy, though still pretty tasty, scones was passed around. Between bouts of the strange vertigo that afflicted her, Nadine Coombs had baked them in an outdoor oven. The oven itself had recently been hauled from the ruins of the Lowe's in Maylock using sledges and Tiffany's horses. It flabbergasted Lila sometimes, the rate of progress they were making, the speed and efficiency with which problems were solved and advancements made. At some point, Lila ended up with the baby. "Are you the last man on Earth or the first?" she asked him. Alexander Peter Bear yawned.
Sorry, Lila. He doesn't talk to cops.
Tiffany had sidled up beside her in the corner of the living room.
That so? We teach 'em young around here, Tiffany said.
Since their adventure, they'd become odd friends. Lila liked how Tiffany rode around town on her horses, wearing her white cowboy hat, insisting that children come over and stroke the animals' necks and see how soft and warm they were. 2 One day, with nothing better to do, Lila and Tiffany searched the dueling YMCA, not knowing exactly what they were looking for, only knowing it was one of the few places that hadn't been investigated. They found plenty of stuff, some of it interesting, but nothing they really needed. There was toilet paper, but supplies of that in the shop well were still plentiful. There were also cartons of liquid soap, but over the years it had hardened into pink bricks. The pool had dried up. Nothing remained but a faint, astringent odor of chlorine. The men's locker room was damp and dank. Luxuriant growths of mold, green, black, yellow, spanned the walls. A varmint's mummified corpse lay at the far end of the room, its legs stiff in the air, its face frozen in a savage death gape, lips stretched away from rows of sharp teeth. Lila and Tiffany stood for a moment in silent contemplation of the first urinal in a row of 6.
Perfectly preserved, said Lila.
Tiffany gave her a quizzical look.
That?
Pointing at the varmint.
No, this.
Lila patted the top of the urinal, her wedding ring clicking against the porcelain.
We'll want it for our museum. We can call it the Museum of Lost Men.
Ha, Tiffany said.
Tell you what, this is a scary fucking place. And believe me, that is saying something because I have toured some real dungeons. I mean, I could write you a guidebook of the sweaty, drafty, fucked up meth caves of Appalachia, but this is truly unpleasant. I knew men's locker rooms were creepy places, but this is worse than I could ever have imagined. It was probably better before it got old, Lila said. But she wondered. They used hammers and chisels to break the combination locks off the lockers. Lila found stopped watches, wallets full of useless green paper and useless plastic rectangles, dead smartphones thus rendered stupid, key rings, moth-eaten trousers, and a caved-in basketball. Tiffany's haul wasn't much better. An almost full box of Tic Tacs and a faded photograph of a bald man with a hairy chest standing on a beach with his little laughing daughter perched on his shoulders.
Florida, I bet, Tiffany said. That's where they go if they got the scratch.
Probably. The photo made Lila think of her own son, which she increasingly felt was counterproductive, not that she could keep from doing it. Mary had filled her in on Clint, stalling to keep the officers at the prison, and Jared, hiding their bodies, our other bodies, she thought, in the attic of the show house up the street. Would she hear any more about either of them? A couple of other women had appeared since Mary, but none of them knew anything about her two guys, and why would they? Jared and Clint were on a spaceship, and the spaceship was getting farther and farther away, so many light years, and eventually they'd slip from the galaxy entirely, and that would be the end. Finito. When should she begin to mourn them? Had she already started?
Aw, said Tiffany. Don't.
What? But Tiffany had read her face somehow, seen right through to the hopelessness and the muddle.
Don't let it get you.
Lila returned the photo to its locker and shut the door. In the gymnasium upstairs, Tiffany challenged her to a game of horse. The prize was the almost full box of Tic Tacs. They pumped up the basketball. Neither of them had any talent for the game. Clint's daughter, who had turned out to not be his daughter, would have dispatched them both with ease. Tiffany shot everything granny style, underhanded, which Lila found annoyingly girly but also cute. When she had her coat off, you could see her pregnant stomach protrude, a bulb at Tiffany's waist.
Why dueling? Why us? Those are the questions, wouldn't you say?
Lila trotted after the basketball. Tiffany had shot it into the dusty bleachers to the right of the court.
I've got a theory.
You do? Let's have it. Lila hurled the basketball from the bleachers. It missed the basket by a couple of car lengths and bounced into the second row of the opposite set of bleachers.
That was pathetic, Tiffany said.
You're one to talk.
I'll admit that.
We've got a couple of doctors and a few nurses. We've got a veterinarian. We've got a bunch of teachers. Kaylee knew her way around a circuit, and although she's gone, Magda isn't bad. We've got a carpenter. We've got a couple of musicians. We've got a sociologist who's already writing a book about the new society.
Yeah, and when it's done, Molly can print it with her berry juice ink.
Tiffany snickered. We've got that retired engineering professor from the university. We've got seamstresses and gardeners and cooks out the yin-yang. The book club ladies are running an encounter group so women can talk about the stuff they miss and get out some of the sadness and grief. We've even got a horse whisperer. See? Tiffany retrieved the basketball.
See what?
We're all we need, Lila said. She had descended from the bleachers and stood with her arms crossed at the baseline of the court.
That's why we were chosen. Every basic skill we need to survive is here.
Okay, maybe.
Could be.
Sounds about right to me. Tiffany took off her cowboy hat and fanned herself with it. She was plainly amused.
You are such a cop. Solving the mysteries.
Lila wasn't done, though. So how do we keep things going? We've already got our first baby. And how many pregnant women are there? A dozen? Eight?
Could be as many as 10.
That enough to jumpstart a new world, you think? When half of them's apt to be girls?
I don't know. Lila was riffing now, her face feeling hot as ideas came to her.
But it's a start. And I bet you there's cold storage facilities with generators that were programmed to run and run and are still running. You'd have to go to a city to find one, I'd guess, but I bet you could. And there would be frozen sperm samples there. And that would be enough to get a world, a new world, going.
Tiffany stuck her hat on the back of her head and thumped the basketball off the floor a couple of times.
New world, huh?
She could have planned it this way. The woman, Eve, so we could start over again without men. At least at the beginning, Lila said.
Garden of Eden with no Adam, huh? Okay, Chief, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Is it a good plan, what that woman set up for us?
A fair question, Lila thought. The inhabitants of our place had discussed Eve Black endlessly. The rumors that had started in the old world had been carried into the new world. It was a rare meeting when her name, if it was her name, did not come up. She was an extension and a possible answer to the original questions, the great how and why of their situation. They discussed the likelihood that she was something more than a woman, more than human, and there was increasing unity in the belief that she was the source of everything that had happened. On the one hand, Lila mourned the lives that had been lost, Millie, Nell, Kaylee, Jessica Elway before them, and how many others, as well as the histories and existences from which those that still lived had been separated. Their men and boys were gone. Yet most, Lila definitely among them, could not deny the renewal before them. Tiffany Jones with full cheeks and clean hair and a second heartbeat. In the old world, there were men who had hurt Tiff, and badly. In the old world, there were men who burned women, thus incinerating them in both realities. Blowtorch brigades, Mary said they were being called. There were bad women and there were bad men. If anyone could claim the right to make that statement, Lila, who had arrested plenty of both, felt that she could. But men fought more. They killed more. That was one way in which the sexes had never been equal. They were not equally dangerous. So yes, Lila thought it was probably a good plan. Merciless, but very good. A world restarted by women had a chance to be safer and fairer. And yet, I don't know. Lila couldn't say that an existence without her son was better. She could conceptualize the idea, but she couldn't articulate it without feeling like a traitor to both Jared and to her old life. Tiffany nodded.
How about this, then? Can you shoot backwards?
She turned away from the basket, bent her knees low, and flipped the ball over her head. It went up, caromed off the corner of the square, caught the rim, and fell off. Bounce, bounce, bounce. So close. 3. An ochre gush belched from the tap. A pipe clanked loudly against another pipe. The brownish flow sputtered, stopped, and then, hallelujah, clean water began to pour into the sink.
Well, said Magda Dubcek to the small assembly around the work sink set against the wall of the water treatment plant.
There it is.
Incredible, said Janice Coates.
Nah, pressure, gravity, not so complex. We be careful, turn on one neighborhood each at a time. Slow but steady, win the race.
Lila, thinking of the ancient note from Magda's son Anton, undoubtedly a dope and a coxman, but pretty damn sharp about the ways of water in his own right, abruptly hugged the old lady.
Oh, said Magda. All right. Thanks.
The water echoed in the long room of the Dueling County Water District plant, hushing them all. In silence, the women took turns passing their hands through the fresh stream. 4. One of the things everyone missed was the ability to just jump in a car and drive somewhere instead of walking and getting blisters. The cars were still there, some in pretty good shape from being parked in garages, and at least some of the batteries they found in storage still held juice. The real problem was gasoline. Every drop had oxidized during the in-between period.
"We'll have to refine some,"
the retired engineering professor explained at a committee meeting. Not more than 150 miles distant, in Kentucky, there were storage wells and refineries that might be restarted with work and luck. They immediately began to plan another journey. They assigned tasks and selected volunteers. Lila scanned the women in the room for signs of misgivings. There were none. Among the faces, she took special note of Celia Frode, the only survivor of the exploration party. Celia nodded along with the rest of them.
"Put me on that list," Celia said. "I'll go. Feel a need to put on my rambling shoes."
It would be risky, but they would be more careful this time. And they would not flinch. 5. When they got to the second floor of the demo house, Tiffany announced that she wasn't climbing the ladder to the attic.
"I'll wait here."
"If you're not coming up, why'd you come at all?" Lila asked. "You're not that pregnant."
"I was hoping you'd give me some of your Tic Tacs, ringer.
And I'm plenty pregnant enough, believe me." Lila had one horse and the mints. "Here," she tossed the box to Tiffany and climbed up the ladder. The Pine Hills show house had, ironically, proved to be better constructed than almost every other structure on Tremaine, including Lila's own. Although dim, small windows smudged by the passage of seasons, the attic was dry. Lila paced the space, her footfalls drawing puffs of dust from the floor. Mary had said that this was the one where she and Lila and Mrs. Ransom were, back there, wherever back there was. She wanted to feel herself, to feel her son. She didn't feel anything. At one end of the attic, a moth was batting against one of the dirty windows. Lila walked over to release it. The window was stuck. Lila heard creaking as, behind her, Tiffany climbed the ladder. She moved Lila aside, took out a pocket knife, worked the point around the edges, and the window went up. The moth escaped and flew away. Below, there was snow on the overgrown lawns, on the busted-up street, on her dead cruiser in Mrs. Ransom's driveway. Tiffany's horses were poking their noses around, nickering about whatever it was that horses nickered about, switching their tails. Lila could see past her own house, past the pool that she had never wanted and that Anton had tended, and past the elm tree that he had left her the note about. An orange animal trotted from the shadowy edge of the pine woods that backed the neighborhood. It was a fox. Even at this distance, the luster of its winter coat was evident. How had it got to be winter so soon? Tiffany stood in the middle of the attic. It was dry, but also cold, especially with the window open. She held out the box of Tic Tacs for Lila to take back.
"I wanted to eat them all, but it would have been wrong. I've given up my life of crime."
Lila smiled and put them back in her own pocket. "I declare you rehabilitated." The women stood about a foot apart, looking at each other, breathing steam. Tiffany pulled off her hat and dropped it on the floor.
"If you think that's a joke, it's not. I don't want to take anything from you, Lila. I don't want to take anything from anybody."
"What do you want?" asked Lila.
"My very own life. Baby and a place and stuff. People that love me."
Lila closed her eyes. She'd had all those things. She couldn't feel Jared, couldn't feel Clint, but she could remember them, could remember her very own life. It hurt, those memories. They made shapes in the snow, like the angels they'd made as children, but those shapes became fuzzier every day. God, she was lonesome.
"That's not so much," Lila said, and reopened her eyes. "It seems like a lot to me."
Tiffany reached out and drew Lila's face to hers. 6. The fox trotted away from the Pine Hills development, across Tremaine Street, and into the thick stands of winter wheat that had grown up on the far side. He was hunting for the smell of hibernating ground squirrels. The fox loved ground squirrels. Crunchy, juicy. And on this side of the tree, unbothered for so long by human habitation, they had grown careless. After a half hour's search, he discovered a little family of them in a dugout chamber. They never awoke, even as he was crushing them between his teeth. "So tasty," he said to himself. The fox went on, entering the deep woods, making for the tree. He paused briefly to explore an abandoned house. He pissed on a pile of books scattered on the floor and nosed fruitlessly around in a closet full of rotting linens. In the kitchen of the house, there was food in the refrigerator that smelled deliciously spoiled, but his attempts to bump the door ajar accomplished nothing. "Let me in there," the fox demanded of the fridge, just in case it was only pretending to be a dead thing. The fridge loomed, unresponsive. A copperhead slid out from under the wood stove on the far side of the kitchen. "Why are you glowing?" it asked the fox. Other animals had commented on this phenomenon and were wary of it. The fox saw it himself when he looked into still water and saw his reflection. A gold light clung to him. It was her mark. "I've had some good fortune," the fox said. The copperhead wriggled its tongue at him. "Come here. Let me bite you." The fox ran from the cabin. Various birds heckled him as he loped beneath the canopy of gnarled and tangled bare branches, but their petty jibes meant nothing to the fox, whose belly was full and whose coat was thick as a bear's. When he emerged into the clearing, the tree was there, the centerpiece of a leafy, steaming oasis in the fields of snow. His paws crossed over from the cold ground to the rich, warm summer loam that was the tree's forever bed. The tree's branches were layered and blended in countless greens, and beside the passage in the bowl, the white tiger, flicking its great tail, watched him approach with sleepy eyes. "Don't mind me," said the fox. "Just passing through." He darted by, into the black hole, and out the opposite side. Chapter 7 1 Don Peters and Eric Blass had yet to be relieved at the West Lavin roadblock when a banged-up Mercedes SL600 came trundling toward them from the prison. Don was standing in the weeds, shaking off after a leak. He zipped up in a hurry and returned to the pickup that served as their cruiser. Eric was standing in the road with his gun drawn. "Stow the cannon, Junior," Don said, and Eric holstered his Glock. The driver of the Mercedes, a curly-haired man with a florid face, pulled to an obedient stop when Don raised his hand. Sitting beside him was a good-looking woman. Make that astoundingly good-looking, especially after all the zombie chicks he and Eric had seen the last few days. Also, she was familiar. "License and registration," Don said. He had no orders to look at drivers' IDs, but it was what cops said when they made a stop. "Watch this, Junior," he thought. "See how a man does it." The driver handed over his license. The woman rooted around in the glove compartment and found the registration. The man was Garth Flickinger, M.D., from Dueling, with a listed residence in the town's fanciest neighborhood, over on Briar. "Mind telling me what you were doing up at the prison?" "That was my idea, officer," the woman said. God, she was good-looking. No bags under this bitch's eyes. Don wondered what she'd been taking to keep her so bushy-tailed. "I'm Michaela Morgan, from News America," Eric exclaimed. "I knew I recognized you!" It meant jack shit to Don, who didn't watch network news, let alone the blah-blah crap they put out 24/7 on the cable, but he remembered where he'd seen her. "Right! The squeaky wheel! You were drinking there!" She gave him a high-voltage smile, all capped teeth and high cheekbones. "That's right. A man gave a speech about how God was punishing women for wearing pants. It was very interesting." Eric said,
Could I have your autograph? It would be something cool to have after you...
He stopped in confusion.
After I fall asleep, she said. I think the bottom may have fallen out of the autograph market, at least temporarily. But if Garth, Dr. Flickinger, has got a pen in his glove compartment, I don't see why...
Forget that, Don said harshly. He was embarrassed by his young partner's lack of professionalism.
I want to know why you were up at the prison, and you aren't going anywhere until you tell me.
Of course, officer.
She spotlighted him with her smile again.
Although my professional name is Morgan, my real name is Coates, and I'm from right here in town. In fact, the warden is...
Coates is your mother?
Don was shocked. But once you got past her nose, which was arrow sharp while old Janice's honker was crooked, he could see the resemblance.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but your mother isn't with us anymore.
I know.
No smile now. Dr. Norcross told me. We spoke to him on the intercom.
The man is an asshole,
the Flickinger guy said. Don grinned, just couldn't help it.
I'll double down on that.
He handed back the paperwork.
Wouldn't let her in,
Flickinger marveled.
Wouldn't even let her say goodbye to her own mother.
Well, Michaela said, the complete truth is that wasn't the only reason I persuaded Garth to take me up there. I also wanted an interview with a woman named Eve Black. I'm sure you've heard the chatter about how she sleeps and wakes.
It would have been quite a scoop, you know. The outside world doesn't care about much these days, but it would care about that. Only Norcross said she was inside a cocoon, like all the rest of the inmates.
Don felt compelled to set her straight. Women, even women reporters, it seemed, could be painfully gullible.
Pure bullshit, and everybody knows it. She's different, special, and he's holding on to her for some crazy reason of his own. But that's going to change.
He dropped her a wink, ponderous enough to include Garth, who winked back.
Be nice to me, and I might get you that interview once we spring her.
Michaela giggled.
I better look in your trunk, I guess, Don said, just so I can say I did.
Garth got out and wrenched open his trunk, which rose with a weary squall. Geary had taken a few swipes here as well. He hoped this clown wouldn't check beneath the spare tire. It was where he had sequestered the baggie of purple lightning. The clown didn't bother, just took a quick look and gave a nod. Garth closed the trunk. This produced an even louder squall, the sound of a cat with its paw caught in a door.
What happened to your car?
Eric asked as Garth got back behind the wheel. Garth opened his mouth to tell the lad that a crazed animal control officer had laid into it, then remembered the crazed animal control officer was now, according to Norcross, the acting sheriff.
Kids, he said. Vandals. They see something nice and they just want to destroy it, don't they?
The clown bent down to look at the pretty lady.
I'm heading down to the squeak when my shift is over. If you're still awake, I'd love to buy you a drink.
That would be wonderful, Michaela said, just as if she meant it.
You guys drive carefully and have a good evening, the clown said.
Garth dropped the transmission into drive, but before he could turn onto the main road, the kid shouted,
Wait!
Garth stopped. The kid was bending down, hands on his knees, looking at Michaela.
How about that autograph?
There was a pen in the glove compartment, it turned out. A nice one with Garth Flickinger, M.D. stamped in gold on the barrel. Michaela scribbled, To Eric with best wishes, on the back of a drug rep's business card and handed it over. Garth got rolling while the kid was still thanking her. Less than a mile down Route 31 toward town, they spotted a town cruiser coming toward them, moving fast.
Slow down, Michaela said.
As soon as the cruiser disappeared over the hill behind them, she told him to step on it. Garth did.
2.
For 2 years, Lila had pestered Clint to add her various contacts to his own in case of trouble at the prison. 6 months ago, he had finally done it, mostly to get her off his case, and now he thanked God for her persistence. First, he called Jared and told him to sit tight. If all went well, he told his son, someone would be along to pick him up before dark. possibly in an RV. Then he closed his eyes, said a brief prayer for eloquence, and called the lawyer who had facilitated Eve Black's transfer to the prison. After 5 rings, as Clint was resigning himself to voicemail, Barry Holden answered.
Holden here.
He sounded uninterested and exhausted. This is Clint Norcross, Barry. Up at the prison?
Clint?
No more than that. I need you to listen to me, very carefully. Nothing from Barry Holden. Are you there? After a pause, Barry replied in that same uninterested voice.
I'm here.
Where are Clara and your daughters? 4 girls, ages 12 to 3. A terrible thing for the father who loved them, but maybe a good thing for Clint, awful as that was to think of. He didn't have to talk about the fate of the world, only about the fate of Barry's female hostages to fortune.
Upstairs, sleeping.
Barry laughed. Not a real laugh, though, just ha-ha-ha, like a dialogue balloon in a comic book. Well, you know, wrapped up in those things. I'm in the living room with a shotgun. If anybody shows up here with so much as a lit match, I'm gonna blow them away. I think there might be a way to save your family. I think they could wake up. Does that idea interest you? Is it the woman? Something new crept into Barry's voice. Something alive. Is it true, what they're saying? That she can sleep and then wake up? If it's only a rumor, be straight with me. I can't stand to hope unless there's a reason to. It's true. Now listen. 2 people are coming to see you. One's a doctor, the other is Warden Coates' daughter. Michaela's still awake, even after all this time? Barry had begun to sound like his old self. Not impossible, I guess. Gerda, my eldest, held out until last night, but still pretty remarkable. She's not just awake. She's totally awake, unlike every other woman in the Tri-Counties who's still got her eyes open. The woman we've got in custody up here did it. Just breathed down her throat and woke her up. If this is a joke, Norcross, it's an extremely bad you'll see for yourself. They're going to tell you everything, then ask you to do some pretty dangerous stuff. I don't want to say you're our only hope, but... Clint closed his eyes, rubbed at his temple with his free hand. But that might be what you are, and time is very short. I would do anything for my wife and girls, Barry said. Anything. Clint allowed himself a long exhalation of relief. Buddy, I was hoping you'd say that. 3. Barry Holden did indeed have a shotgun. It wasn't new, having been handed down through 3 generations of Holdens, but he had cleaned it and oiled it, and it looked lethal enough. He listened to Garth and Michaela with it laid across his thighs. Beside him, on an end table decorated with one of Clara Holden's lace doilies, was an open box of fat red shells. Talking turn and turn about, Michaela and Garth told the lawyer what Clint had told them. How Eve Black's arrival roughly coincided with Aurora's first reported victims, how she had killed 2 men with her bare hands, how she had allowed herself to be taken into custody without a struggle, saying it was what she wanted, how she had banged her face repeatedly into the protective mesh of Lila's cruiser, how the bruises had healed with magical speed. Besides fixing me up, she knew things about me she couldn't possibly have known, Michaela said. And they say she can control the rats. I know that's hard to believe, but... Garth interrupted. Another prisoner, Fitzroy, told us she used rats to get the assistant warden's cell phone. And she does have a cell phone. I saw it. There's more, Michaela said. She claims to have killed Judge Silver. She claimed... She paused, reluctant to say it. But Clint had told them to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Remember that he may be grieving, Clint had said, but he's still a lawyer and a damned good one. He can smell a lie at 40 yards, even upwind. She claimed she did it using moths, because Silver was trying to bring in someone from out of town, and that's not allowed. Michaela knew that a week ago, This was where Barry Holden would have decided they were either sharing a pernicious delusion or trying on the world's worst and most stoned prank, and invited them to leave his house. But it wasn't a week ago. Instead of telling them to get out, Barry handed his grandfather's shotgun to Michaela. "Hold this." There was a laptop on the coffee table. Barry sat on the couch, also liberally decorated with his wife's needlework, and began tapping away. After a moment, he looked up. "Bridger County Police are reporting an accident on the old Coughlin Road. One fatality. No name, but the vehicle was a Land Rover. Judge Silver drives a Land Rover." He regarded Michaela Coates. What they were telling him, essentially, was that the fate of every woman on planet Earth depended on what happened here in Dueling over the next few days. It was mad, but Warden Coates' daughter, sitting there in Clara's favorite Bentwood rocker and looking at him earnestly, was the best argument that it was true. Possibly an irrefutable argument. A news report on CNN that morning had said that less than 10% of the world's women were estimated to still be awake on Aurora Day 5. Barry didn't know about that, but he would have been willing to bet Grandpa Holden's shotgun that none of them looked like Michaela. "She just, what, kissed you? Like when the prince kissed Princess Aurora in the cartoon?" "Yes," said Michaela. "Like that. And she breathed down my throat. I think that's what really did it. Her breath." Barry switched his attention to Garth. "You saw this?" "Yes, it was amazing. Mickey here looked like a vampire after a fresh transfusion." And when he caught Michaela's frowning stare, "Sorry, darling, maybe not the best metaphor." "That was actually a simile," she said coldly. Barry was still trying to get his mind around it. "And she says they'll come for her, the cops, the townies, and that Frank Geary's in charge?" "Yes." Michaela had left out everything Evie had said about the sleeping women having to make their own decision. Even if true, that part was out of their hands. "I know Geary," Barry said. "I never defended him, but he's been in district court a couple of times. I remember a case where a woman complained that he threatened her for not keeping her Rottweiler on a leash. He has what you call anger issues." "Tell me about it," Garth murmured. Barry looked at him, eyebrows raised. "Never mind," Garth said. "Not important." Barry took back his shotgun. "Okay, I'm in. For one thing, I've got nothing else to do with Clara and the girls gone. For another, I want to see this mystery woman with my own eyes. What does Clint want from me?" "He said you have a Winnebago," Michaela said, "to go camping in with your wife and girls." Barry smiled. "Not a Winnebago, a Fiesta. Sucks a ton of gas, but it sleeps six. The girls squabble almost nonstop, but we had some good times in that old thing." His eyes abruptly filled with tears. "Some very, very good times." 4. Barry Holden's Fleetwood Fiesta was parked in a small lot behind the old-fashioned granite block of a building where he kept his office. The RV was a monstrous, zebra-striped thing. Barry sat behind the wheel while Michaela climbed into the passenger seat. They waited for Garth to reconnoiter the cop shop. The Holden family's heirloom shotgun lay on the floor between them. "Does this have any chance at all, do you think?" Barry asked. "I don't know," Michaela replied. "I hope so, but I really don't know." "Well, it's nuts, no doubt about that," Barry said. "But it beats sitting home and thinking bad thoughts." "You have to see Evie Black to really understand. Speak to her. You have to..." She searched for the right word. "You have to experience her. She..." Michaela's cell phone rang. It was Garth. "There's a geezer with a beard sitting under an umbrella on one of the benches out front, but otherwise the coast is clear. No cruisers in the side lot, just a few personal vehicles. If we're going to do this, I think we better hurry up. That RV is not what I'd call unobtrusive." "Coming now," Michaela said. She ended the call. The alley between Barry's building and the one next to it was narrow, There couldn't have been more than 5 inches of clearance for the lumbering Fleetwood on either side, but Barry threaded its length with the ease of long experience. He stopped at the mouth of the alley, but Main Street was deserted. It's almost as if the men are gone too, Michaela thought, as Barry made a wide right turn and drove the 2 blocks to the municipal building. He parked the Fleetwood in front, taking 3 spaces marked Official Business Only, Others Will Be Towed. They got out and Garth joined them. The man with the beard got up and ambled over, holding the umbrella over his head. The stem of a pipe poked up from the bib of his Oshkosh overalls. He held out his hand to Barry and said,
"Hello there, counselor."
Barry shook with him. "Hey, Willie, good to see you, but I can't stop to chew the fat. We're in sort of a hurry. Urgent business." Willie nodded.
"I'm waiting for Lila. I know the chances are good that she's asleep, but I'm hoping not. Want to talk to her. I went back out to that trailer where those meth heads got killed. Something funny out there. Not just fairy handkerchiefs. The trees are full of moths. Wanted to talk to her about it, maybe take her to see. If not her, then whoever's supposed to be in charge."
"This is Willie Burke," Barry told Garth and Michaela. "Volunteer fire department, adopt a highway, coaches Pop Warner, all around good guy. But we're really pressed for time, Willie, so
if it was Lenny Mars you came to talk to, you better hurry up."
Willie's eyes flicked from Barry to Garth to Michaela. They were deep set, caught in nets of wrinkles, but sharp.
"She was still awake the last time I popped in, but she's fading fast."
"No deputies around?" Garth asked.
"Nope, all out on patrol. Except maybe for Terry Coombs. I heard he's a little under the weather. Struck drunk, don't you know?"
The 3 of them started up the steps to the triple doors.
"Haven't seen Lila then?"
Willie called after them.
"No," Barry said. "Well, maybe I'll wait a little longer."
And Willie wandered back to his bench.
"Something funny out there, all right. All those moths. And the place has got a vibration."
5. Lenny Mars, part of the 10% of Earth's female population still holding out on that Monday, continued to walk around with her laptop, but now she was moving slowly, occasionally stumbling and bumping into the furniture. To Michaela, she looked like a wind-up toy that had almost run down. 2 hours ago, that was me, she thought. Lenny walked past them, staring at her laptop with her bloodshot eyes, not seeming to realize they were there until Barry tapped her on the shoulder. Then she jumped, her hands flying up. Garth caught her laptop before it could crash to the floor. On the screen was a video of the London Eye. In slow motion, it tottered and rolled into the Thames again and again. Hard to tell why anyone would want to destroy the London Eye, but apparently someone had felt a need to do so.
"Barry, you scared the dickens out of me."
"I'm sorry," he said. "Terry sent me to get some of the hardware from the weapons room. I guess he wants it up to the prison. May I have the key, please?"
"Terry," she frowned. "Why would he? Lila's the sheriff, not Terry. You know that."
"Lila, right," Barry said. "It's Lila's order via Terry." Garth went to the doors and looked out, convinced that a sheriff's department cruiser would pull up at any moment. Maybe 2 or 3. They would be thrown in jail, and this lunatic adventure would be over before it even got started. So far, there was no one but the bearded guy sitting out there under his umbrella, like patience on her monument. But that couldn't last. "Can you help me out, Lenny? For Lila?"
"Sure, I'll be glad to see you're back," Lenny said.
She went to her desk and put her laptop down. On the screen, the London Eye fell and fell and fell.
"That guy Dave is running things until she does. Or maybe his name is Pete. Confusing to have 2 Petes around. In any case, I don't know about him. He's very serious."
She rummaged in her wide top drawer and brought out a heavy ring of keys. She peered at them. Her eyes drifted closed. White threads immediately rose from her eyelashes, wavering in the air. "Lenny," Barry said sharply, "wake up." Her eyes snapped open and the threads disappeared.
I am awake. Stop shouting.
She ran a finger along the keys, making them jingle.
I know it's one of them.
Barry took them. I'll find it. Miss Morgan, maybe you'd like to go back to the RV and wait there. No, thanks. I want to help. It will be quicker that way. At the back of the main room was an unmarked metal door painted a particularly unappetizing shade of green. There were two locks. Barry found the key that fitted the top one easily enough. The second, however, was taking more time. Michaela thought Lila might have kept that key for herself. It might be in her pocket, buried under one of those white cocoons. Do you see anyone coming? She called to Garth. Not yet, but hurry up. This is making me need to pee. There were only three keys left on the ring when Barry found the one that turned the second lock. He opened the door, and Michaela saw a small closet-sized room with rifles stowed in racks and pistols nestled in styrofoam-lined cubbies. There were shelves stacked with boxes of ammunition. On one wall was a poster showing a Texas Ranger in a 10-gallon hat, pointing a revolver with a huge black barrel. "I fought the law, and the law won," read the line beneath. "Get as much of the ammo as you can," Barry said. "I'll get the M4s and some of the Glocks." Michaela started for the ammo shelves, then changed her mind and went back into the dispatch area. She grabbed Lenny's wastebasket and turned it over, dumping out a heap of crumpled paper and takeout coffee cups. Lenny took no notice. Michaela loaded as many boxes of ammunition as she thought she could carry into the wastebasket and left the secure room with the basket clasped in her arms. Garth brushed past her to get his own armload of weaponry. Barry had left one of the triple entry doors open. Michaela staggered down the wide stone steps through the thickening rain in time to see Barry reach the Fleetwood. The bearded man got up from his bench, still holding his umbrella over his head. He said something to Barry, who replied. Then the bearded man, Willie, opened the RV's rear door so Barry could put in his armload of guns. Michaela joined him, panting. Barry took the wastebasket from her and dumped the boxes of ammo on top of the jackstraw pile of guns. They went back together while Willie stood beneath his umbrella, watching. Garth came out with a second load of armament, his pants sagging under the weight of the ammo boxes he had shoved into all his pockets. "What did the old guy say to you?" Michaela asked. "He wanted to know if we were doing something Sheriff Norcross would approve of," Barry replied. "I said we were." They went back inside and hurried to the secure room. They had taken about half the weaponry. Michaela spotted something that looked like a submachine gun afflicted with the mumps. "We should definitely take that. I think it's the tear gas launcher thingy. I don't know if we need it, but I don't want anyone else to have it." Garth rejoined them. "I come bearing bad news, Counselor Holden. Truck with a jackpot light on the dash just pulled up behind your RV. They hurried to the doors and peered out through the smoked glass. Two men were getting out of the truck, and Michaela recognized them both. The clown and his autograph hound partner. "Oh, Christ," Barry said. "That's Don Peters from the prison. What's he doing pretending to be a cop? The man has the brains of an insect." "That particular insect was most recently seen manning a roadblock near the prison," Garth said. "Same bug, same truck." The bearded man approached the newcomers, said something, and pointed further up Main Street. Peters and his young partner ran to their truck and jumped in. The light bars came on, and they pulled out with the siren screaming.
"What's going on?" Lenny asked in a distracted voice. "Just what in the doodly fuck is going on?"
"Everything's fine," Garth said and gave her a smile. "Not to worry."
Then to Barry and Michaela,
"May I suggest we quit while we're ahead?" "What's going on?" Lenny wailed. "Oh, this is all just a bad dream."
"Hang in there, miss," Garth said. "It might get better."
The three of them left, running once they got to the concrete path. Michaela had the grenade launcher in one hand and a bag of tear gas shells in the other. She felt like Bonnie Parker. Willie was standing beside the Fleetwood.
"How did you get those guys out of here?" Barry asked.
"Told them someone was shooting up the hardware store. They won't be long, so I think you folks better roll."
Willie snapped his umbrella closed.
And I think I better roll with you. Those two ain't gonna be happy campers when they come back.
Why would you help us like this? Garth asked.
Well, it's strange days now, and a man has got to trust his instincts. Mine have always been pretty good. Barry here's always been a friend to Lila, even though he bats for the other team in court. I now recognize this girl here from the TV news.
He peered at Garth.
You I don't like the looks of so much, but you're with them, so what the hell? Besides, the die is cast, as they say. Where are we going?
First to pick up Lila's son, Barry said, then up to the prison. How would you like to take part in a siege, Willie? Because that may be what's shaping up. Willie smiled, showing tobacco-stained teeth.
Well, I had a coonskin cap when I was a kid, and I always liked movies about the Alamo, so why not? Help me up the steps of this rig, would you? The goddamn rain plays hell with my rheumatism.
6. Jared, waiting at the door of the demo house, was getting ready to call his father again when a huge RV pulled up in front. Jared recognized the driver. Like his mother's deputies and many other town officials, Barry Holden had been a dinner guest at the Norcross house on occasion. Jared met him on the stoop.
Come on, Barry said. We have to go.
Jared hesitated. My mom and three others are in the attic. It was really hot up there before the rain started, and it will be hot again tomorrow. You should help me get them down.
It will cool off fast tonight, Jared, and we have no time.
Barry didn't know if the cocooned women could feel heat or cold, but he did know that their window of opportunity was rapidly closing. He also thought that Lila and the others might be better off stashed away here on this quiet street. He had insisted on bringing his own wife and daughters along because of the RV. It was well known in dueling, and he was afraid of reprisals.
Can we at least tell someone?
That's a decision your father can make. Please, Jared.
Jared allowed himself to be led down the walk to the idling Fleetwood. The back door opened, and his old Pop Warner coach leaned out. Jared smiled in spite of himself.
Coach Burke!
Well, look at this, Willie exclaimed. The only pee-wee quarterback I ever had who didn't drop every other snap. Climb in here, son.
But the first thing Jared saw was the array of guns and ammo on the floor.
Holy shit, what are these for?
A woman sat on the plaid couch just inside the door. She was young, extremely pretty, and vaguely familiar, but the most remarkable thing about her was how awake she looked. She said, "Hopefully just insurance." A man standing in the passage in front of her laughed.
I wouldn't bet on that, Mickey.
He held out his hand. Garth Flickinger. Behind Garth Flickinger, on a matching couch, were arranged four cocooned bodies, each smaller than the previous, like a set of separated nesting dolls.
That's Mr. Holden's wife and daughters, I'm told, Coach Burke said.
The RV started rolling. Jared staggered. Willie Burke steadied him, and as Jared shook with Mr. Flickinger, he thought that maybe all of this was a dream. Even the guy's name seemed like something out of a dream. Who in the real world was named Garth Flickinger?
Pleased to meet you, he said.
In his peripheral vision, the Holden women rolled against one another as the RV went around a corner. Jared told himself not to see them. But there was no not seeing them, reduced to mummified dolls.
Jared Norcross.
And dream or no dream, he had a certain resentment. There had been time for Mr. Holden to get his family, hadn't there? And why was that? Because it was his RV? Jared's phone rang as Barry hooked them around the Tremaine Street cul-de-sac. They were leaving his mother, Molly, Mary, and Mrs. Ransom behind. It felt wrong. Everything felt wrong, though, so what else was new? The caller was his father. They spoke briefly, and then Clint asked to speak to Michaela. When she took the phone, Clint said, "Here's what you need to do." She listened. 7.
Deputy Sheriff Reed Barrows had parked Unit 3 directly across the byroad leading to the prison. This was high ground. He and Vern had a clear view down at least 6 miles of Route 31. Reed had expected a ration of shit from Peters about being relieved so soon after they had taken up their post, but Peters had been surprisingly agreeable, probably eager to get an early start on the day's drinking. Maybe the kid was, too. Reed doubted if they were checking IDs at the squeaky wheel this week, and currently the cops had better things to do than enforce alcohol laws. Peters reported they had stopped just a single car, some reporter who'd gone up to the prison hoping to get an interview and been turned away. Reed and Vern had stopped no one at all. Even traffic on the main road was so sparse it was nearly non-existent. The town was in mourning for its women, Reed thought. Hell, the world was in mourning. Reed turned to his partner, who was reading something on his Kindle and picking his nose.
You're not wiping boogers under the seat, are you?
Jesus, no. Don't be disgusting.
Vern raised his rump, pulled a handkerchief from his back pocket, wiped a little green treasure into it, and replaced it.
Tell me something. What exactly are we doing here? Do they really think Norcross is stupid enough to take that woman out into the world when he's got her behind bars right now?
I don't know. If a food truck or something comes along, what are we supposed to do?
Stop it and radio for instructions.
Radio who? Terry or Frank?
About this, Reed was less sure.
Guess I'd try Terry's cell first thing. Leave a message just to cover our asses if he doesn't pick up. Why don't we worry about that if it happens?
Which it probably won't, the mess everything's in.
Yeah, infrastructure's shot to hell.
What's infrastructure?
Look it up on your Kindle, why don't you?
Vern did so.
The basic physical and organizational structures needed for the operation of a society or an enterprise.
Huh. Huh? What does huh mean?
That you're right. It's shot to hell. I went to the Shopwell this morning before I came on. Place looks like a bomb hit it.
Down the hill, in the gray afternoon light, they could see an approaching vehicle.
Reed?
What?
With no women, there's going to be no babies.
You've got a scientific mind, all right, Reed said.
If this doesn't end, where will the human race be in another 60 or 100 years?
This was something Reed Barrows did not want to think about, especially with his wife in a cocoon and his toddler being babysat, probably inadequately, by ancient Mr. Freeman next door. Nor did he have to. The vehicle was now close enough to see it was a humongous, zebra-striped camper and slowing down as if it meant to turn onto the prison road. Not that it could, with three parked across it.
That RV belongs to Holden, said Vern. The lawyer. My brother services it over in Maylock.
The Fleetwood came to a stop. The driver's door opened, and Barry Holden got out. At the same time, the officers got out of three. Holden greeted them with a smile.
Gentlemen, I come bearing good tidings of great joy.
Neither Reed nor Vern returned the smile.
No one goes up to the prison, Mr. Holden, Reed said. Sheriff's orders.
Now, I don't think that's strictly true, Barry said, still smiling.
I believe a gentleman named Frank Geary gave that order, and he's what you might call self-appointed. Isn't that so?
Reed wasn't sure how to respond to this, so he kept silent.
In any case, Barry said, I got a call from Clint Norcross. He's decided that turning the woman over to local law enforcement is the right thing to do.
Well, thank God for that, Vern exclaimed. The man sees reason.
He wants me at the prison to facilitate the deal and make it clear for the public record as to why he went outside of protocol. Just a formality, really.
Reed was about to say, you couldn't find a smaller vehicle to come up here in? Car wouldn't start, maybe? But that was when Three's dash radio blared. It was Terry Coombs, and he sounded upset.
Unit 3, respond! Right now! Right now!